Session number 9965, Reel 3.
Mr. Dimery, Reel 3, how frequently would you have to make an overnight stop?
Well, as I said, we were at Ringway, and Ringway was not too far from the various bomber stations in Yorkshire and Lincoln. So, really, we were quite lucky. We could go out and hopefully get back in the evening. We might make two or three or four deliveries in the day. But of course, the system would break down sometimes if you went out a little late in the afternoon and you landed somewhere miles from home and it was after last landing time. No way could you get back. This didn't happen too frequently in my case, although it did happen. There was absolutely no guarantee whatsoever on any one day that you would be home at night. But in my particular case, I managed to get home most nights. But people in other parts of the country, they were in places miles from anywhere, and their trips were rather longer than ours. For instance, I said earlier on that the average of our trips were about 45 minutes. But the lads up in Prestwick, they may take aircraft from Prestwick down to, say, Thorney Island near Portsmouth, Southampton. That might be 3 hours. Very often it would not be possible for them to get home. In our case, we had taxi aircraft which followed our delivery crews, and we had a sort of a milk run. It was a case of as soon as we took off with our aircraft to go to Yorkshire or Lincolnshire, then the taxi aircraft would perhaps follow or precede us even whilst we were collecting the aircraft. They'd be on their way waiting for us to get out of our delivery flight, get back in the Anson, go back to Ringway, off again, pick up some more Lancasters or Halifaxes. The taxi aircraft would precede us, would go off, and usually at Ringway we'd get home because we were doing short trips. But up in Scotland and other places, they would have much longer trips. They couldn't always organise the taxi to take them back. So sometimes they would be out for perhaps days. Or what they sometimes would do, suppose they'd gone from Prestwick to Thorney Island, they might ring up our base at White Waltham and say, have you got anybody in this area who can pick us up? We're at Thorney Island, where we've got to get back to Prestwick. And if they could organise it at White Waltham, then a taxi pilot would drop in at Thorney Island, pick the chaps up, take them to perhaps White Waltham, or to another aerodrome where maybe there would be a delivery of an aircraft up to Prestwick. There was a lot of phoning to be done, tremendous amount of phoning. But as I say, in our case at Ringway, it was pretty routine.
How tiring did you find these short trips?
Not at all, not in my case. Not at all.
How long was your day?
9 o'clock in the morning till, 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock. There was no time limit. It depended entirely on the number of flying hours available, you see. But we didn't work to a timetable. There was no set timetable at all. Not like in a factory or anything like that.
You were flying sometimes to RAF bases. What sort of a reception did you get there?
Very good. Very good, generally speaking. They Nearly all our deliveries were to RAF bases, and to be quite honest, the RAF were a little bit surprised at the skill of our pilots. They really were, because they, how can I put it tactfully, they really were skillful. They'd mastered the art of flying these heavy bombers, and they could put them down as light as a feather sometimes, and it really shook some of the RAF lads, because I've been at RAF drones 1,000 times and watched some of them landing, and to be quite honest, it was cruel the way some of the aircraft were landed. All mighty bumps and what have you. Not all of them, of course, but our lads took a real pride in trying to show the RAF how to fly, which...
Did you ever fly with any of the women pilots who made it to four engines?
Very, very... Not as a flight engineer. No, I have flown... I think some of the women pilots had acted as taxi pilots in my case. But I've never had a lady pilot as a when she was flying in charge of a four-engine machine, no.
How were you treated as a flight engineer at the RAF base?
Very good, very good.
What yes. status did you have?
Well, we were officer status. We stayed in officer messes, officer's mess. We were treated as officers. We were, our ranks were third officer, second officer, first officer, and what have you. Yes, we were treated very well. I don't know whether they had any feelings towards us, you know, as civilians, because we were in fact civilians. Maybe they had some feelings, I don't know.
What uniform did the flight engineer wear?
Same as the pilots, a blue uniform, dark blue uniform with a little bit of gold braid on their shoulders and things like that.
Did you ever have occasion to take over the controls of the aircraft?
Unofficially, only. Never officially. No, no. In an emergency, you mean, do you? No, never in an emergency. No, nothing at all like that.
Had there been an emergency, were you meant to take over?
Not really. What could one do? There's only a pilot seat. The only aircraft which had dual control were, off the top of my head, were American aircraft, like Liberators. But in a Lancaster, I mean, a flight engineer couldn't do anything. I mean, he'd have to get the pilot out of his seat, and his flying experience would be limited to flying in a straight line, straight and level, not landing the aircraft. And in any case, as I said earlier, it's really a two-man job to organise things to get the aircraft down in one piece. It would be very, very dodgy for a flight engineer to try and take over in an emergency.
Were you ever given any actual instruction?
Not really, no, no.
Could you tell me about your unofficial flights?
Well, I've been with a pilot before now, and flying in Halifax, and he said, "Oh, I'm going back to play with the radio." There was a radio set in the aircraft at the back somewhere, and on occasion he's got out of the pilot seat. I've had to get in and just fly straight and level. When he's disappeared down the back, he said he'd gone to play with the radio. Maybe he went to the toilet, I don't know. It's a guess. But that really would be the only unofficial sort of experience I've had. I seem to remember flying most of the way down from Ringway to St. Athan in an Oxford. I seem to remember doing that. But it must have been dual control. I because the pilot was alongside me. I forget now, it's such a long time ago.
Could you ever request of the pilot that you be allowed to fly it?
Not really. You could ask, and whether he would let you or not would be entirely up to him. But we weren't qualified to fly aeroplanes, that's the point. It was totally unofficial. See?
What would have happened if anybody had found out?
Goodness knows, I don't know. Got it in the neck in some way or other.
Had it ever been spelt out to you that you should not take over
no,
the controls?
No, not as far as I know. No. No.
How easy was it to manoeuvre in the air when you changed over seats?
Well, it wasn't too difficult. You see, when an airplane is trimmed, it will fly, to a certain extent, hands-off for a short period of time, just like a car. I mean, you can take your hands off the wheel of a car for a short period, a very short period. And you could do this with an airplane, no trouble at all. Not really. Yes.
Could you have transferred from a flight engineer to become a pilot?
I don't know. I got an idea at one period towards the end of ATA, or shall we say, well on into the war, some people were taking on from ab initio stage and taught to fly, but I have not heard of any flight engineers being taught to fly.
There are a number of different nationalities in ATA. Did you fly
yes,
with some?
Yes. Poles, Czechs, French, Canadian, American, they were all there, yes. Some of them were very good. Some of them were ex-airline pilots. And some of them couldn't speak very good English. For instance, I remember my wife and I invited one pilot to tea one day. He seemed to be so lonely, he was not a young person, and he was from Estonia. We waited for him to turn up at my digs to have tea, and he never turned up. The following day, or 2 days later, I saw him and I said, we were expecting you to tea on Sunday. And he looked at me with a rather blank expression and shrugged his shoulders and said that he'd gone on leave. Well, the explanation really was, I don't think he understood that I had invited him to tea. As I say, he was an Estonian. He'd been taught English by a Pole. So that didn't make a lot of sense as far as English was concerned.
Did you have any problems in the air with language?
Not really, no. The very experienced ones could speak English quite well. And they were very, very good, some of these Polish pilots.
What about problems with differing temperaments or procedural practices?
Yes. Some were very temperamental. In fact, I can visualize one now, and I mustn't mention any name. And I think he could have a really vicious temper. Very, very temperamental was he. Was a Pole. He was an experienced pilot. I believe I'm right in saying I'm not 100% certain that he flew in the First World War. And I'm not too certain which side he flew on, to be quite honest, either. But he could be a bit awkward at times.
How did you cope with that?
Well, he used to get his back up with the American pilots. He didn't like the American pilots. He found them a little bit brash. And I suspect that the two temperaments were not compatible. And they had a few rows every now and again.
What was your opinion of the American pilots?
Uh, Well, they could fly. They were good. They were all right. There was nothing wrong with them. They were a bit brash, as I said. Some of them were. But nevertheless, very, very nice people. In fact, there weren't any nasty people at all in the whole of ATA that I can think of. It was a remarkable organization. They got a tremendous number of personalities there, all sorts of skills, and they were very, very nice people.
Was there any rivalry?
Not that I'm aware of. Maybe rivalry in as much that some people seem to get a load of Spitfires when everybody else seemed to get Tiger Moths. And they used to squabble about that. Why should he have a Spitfire and I've got a Tiger Moth? Or something like that. But it was that kind of thing. It wasn't no serious rivalry, not as far as I know at any rate.
Were you ever in any awkward situations?
Yes, I suppose there were one or two. Luckily, nothing very, very serious. But there was one little incident one day when a pilot came to me and asked me if I would care for a night out at my home, which is Cardiff, because he said if so, he could organise delivery of a Lancaster from Harden, which is near Chester, down to St. Athens, which is not far from my home. I said, yes, by all means, I'd be glad of a night home. He asked me whether if he could organise it, could I bring my spare Macintosh with me? I didn't ask any questions, and I said, yes, I could do that. Well, in the afternoon, he came to me and said, right, there is a Lancaster for St. Athens. We're taking off at 2 o'clock. So we took off, as I said, 2, and once we got up in the air, he said to me, have you got your Mac with you? I said, yes. He said, well, the reason I want it, he said, is that our organization is coming to an end very shortly. It was now 1945. And he said, I've never given my wife a ride in an aeroplane. So I thought that this is an opportunity where I could bring that about. When I see you tomorrow morning, he lived in Bristol, incidentally, I'll have a lady with me. She'll be dressed in ATA uniform, and I want your Mac to complete the outfit. And the intention is for us to go to an aerodrome near Cheltenham where we have a Stirling that's going to be delivered to Harden. So fair enough, we took our aeroplane, our Lancaster, down to St. Athens. The following morning, Sunday morning, I went over to Bristol and I met him in the tramway centre at Bristol. And sure enough, he had his wife with him, who was dressed in ATA uniform, including my blue Mac. We travelled by bus to this aerodrome near Cheltenham. It was a small drome in the middle of surrounded by woods. It was a grass drome and was obviously a satellite station for a bigger drome not too far away. And there were a number of Stirlings there scattered around the field. The weather was pretty horrible. The cloud base was right down and visibility was pretty poor. We arrived sometime before noon and he said, well, hang about, I'll just check up on the Met report to find out what conditions are like for flying because it wasn't very good at that particular time. He came back about 10 minutes later and said that the weather was pretty horrible. There was solid cloud everywhere, all the way up to Anglesey. But there was a break, a hole in the cloud base at Anglesey. And he suggested that maybe we ought to wait till later on in the afternoon and see if the weather improved. Around about 3 o'clock or so in the afternoon, he went off to check the Met report again, and this time he came back and said, well, look, there's no change in the weather, but there's still a hole in the cloud at Anglesey. He said, what I think we ought to do, he said, I'll take off, we'll make a flip round the aerodrome. I'll make out that I'm going to have a look at the weather, and we'll come in and land. We'll stay the night here. My wife can go back to Bristol. We'll carry on tomorrow morning. I said, all right, well, you're the pilot. It's up to you. So that's what we did. We took off, and we got up to around about 50 or 100 feet, and we ran straight into cloud. There was only one thing to do, and that was to keep on going straight through the cloud. It was impossible to maneuver in any shape or form. And at about 5,000 feet, we broke through the cloud, where, of course, everything was absolutely beautiful in every direction. Glorious sunshine, blue sky, but solid cloud between us. The pilot's wife was looking around with amazement. It looked absolutely fantastic to her, and she doubtless didn't realize what a spot we were in, because it was pretty obvious to me at any rate, and to the pilot, that no way were we going to be able to land at that particular aerodrome that we'd just left. So he set course for Anglesey, and all the time I was looking down, and occasionally I'd see a glimpse of the ground below us. And after a while, we passed the tip of Snowdon poking up through the clouds, just a little weeny bit of it. A minute or two later, we were over Anglesey, and luckily there was still a break in the cloud base. So we beetled round and round in this hole, came out underneath the cloud, flew at about 300 feet along the coast of North Wales towards Harden, which, as I say, is close to Chester. We landed at the aerodrome, stopped at the far side of the drome, let his wife out. She disappeared through a gate somewhere at the other side of the drome, and we taxied to our dispersal point, and that was that. Nobody knew anything at all about it, and as far as I know, nobody'd ever queried what happened. Whilst on the journey up, I couldn't help wondering what on earth the authorities would think if they found the wreck of the aeroplane with three bodies in it, one of whom was a lady who had no authority to be in the aircraft. We had no parachutes or anything like that. Quite frankly, I didn't know what to think. I've since spoken to the pilot many, many years later, and he remembered the incident. Sadly, his wife died a couple of years later, but he's since remarried.
Did you ever hear of a pilot going somewhere where he shouldn't have gone?
Well, I think a pilot would sometimes take advantage of the fact that he was not too far from home. If I can give an example, one day I flew with a pilot. We went up to Silloth, which is in Cumberland, in a Halifax, and there we picked up a Liberator to fly down to Lichfield. Lichfield is in Staffordshire, and the pilot also lives in Staffordshire. We arrived in Lichfield rather late in the afternoon. In fact, it was after the recommended last landing time. But the pilot decided to take off, to take this Liberator further on its journey, which was eventually to Prestwick. There was no way that we could reach Prestwick that evening, and really, we should not have left Lichfield. However, as I say, he lived in Staffordshire, and he decided to take off and stop, presumably without my knowledge, at the nearest drome to his home. We flew for about 15 minutes, and sure enough, a drome appeared right underneath us, which he obviously knew about, and he decided to come into land. This particular Liberator had seen a tremendous amount of service and was very, very much well worn. It was filthy dirty. It had got discoloured windows in it. It was very difficult to see out at the back, and it was rather important that the flight engineer could in fact see out, because there was a check to be carried out which necessitated looking through the windows. Anyway, we started to make our approach to land. Wheels were selected down, and it was the flight engineer's job to check that the wheels had come down. And one of the checks was to see the locks on the landing wheels themselves. I went to the back of the aircraft, and as I say, the windows were opaque, and I couldn't really see through them, so I took the windows out. Great huge windows they were, and dropped them on the floor of the aircraft. I checked that the wheels were down on both sides of the aircraft, and then it was necessary to go up right into the nose compartment of the aircraft and check that the nose wheel was also locked down. I scrambled up the aircraft and went into the nose compartment, and to my dismay, the nose wheel was still retracted and apparently not likely to come down under normal pressure, normal techniques. I went up into the cockpit, where the pilot was now making his final approach to the runway, and I told him that the front nose wheel hadn't come down, and I caught hold of the selector control, which operated the undercarriage and nose wheel, and pushed it down hard, and it kicked back as the pressure built up, and kicked back out of my hand. So I caught hold of it again, and I rammed it down hard and put all my weight on it and held it down. There was an almighty bang and a draft of air, and it was obvious that the nose wheel had come unlocked and presumably was now down. So I went down into the nose wheel compartment, and sure enough, it was now down and locked. We landed at the drome without any trouble, but the landing gear lights kept flickering on and off, which normally indicated that the wheels were not locked down. However, the wheels didn't collapse or anything like that, so we were obviously okay. But nevertheless, I was glad to get out of the aeroplane because, as I say, it had done a tremendous amount of flying and wasn't a particularly airworthy aeroplane to be in. We took it on the following day up to Prestwick, where I believe it was eventually scrapped. As a matter of interest, It's been suggested by some people in ATA that a lot of our work could have been done with a paintbrush. In other words, it would have been quite easy to paint new numbers on aircraft, which would satisfy the Air Ministry in this respect. On this particular, at this particular time, we had taken a Liberator of a certain number from Silloth to Lichfield. And from Lichfield, we had taken another Liberator up to Prestwick. The following day, we had taken another Liberator from Prestwick back down to Lichfield. In other words, if we'd used a paintbrush on the numbers of the aircraft, like the registration numbers of a car, there would be no need to fly the aeroplanes back and forth. All we need to do would be paint the numbers. But of course, that wasn't quite what our job was all about.
Was there any official reprimand for taking off after last landing time?
Not as far as I know. He probably didn't report it. Probably didn't report it, but he shouldn't have taken off, really. It was a mistake.
Would not the ground staff realise what was going on?
Well, it was an RAF drone from which we were taking off, and they would have no control over ATA pilots. Now, they probably...